and welcome to Under the Grid, the podcast exploring the history of Milton Keynes from the collections team at Milton Keynes Museum. We delve deep and not so deep into time to tell you some of our favourite things about the area and share our discoveries from working at the museum. I'm Catherine, I'm the archivist.
I'm Sarah, I'm the collections officer.
And I'm Tabitha, I'm the archaeology curator and collections conservator.
July is a really exciting month. Do you know why?
Why?
Because Milton Keynes is one of the host cities of the Women's European Football Championships.
Woohoo!
It's the second time that England has hosted the European Championships, and they're hosting games at the stadium, the MK Dons Stadium.
Group B, I think. Is it Group B?
What teams are playing?
I said that with great confidence, and now I'm doubting myself.
Germany.
Yes.
Spain?
Maybe.
Finland. Tabby's looked it up. We've got it right.
Yeah, you're missing one. Germany, Spain, Finland, and...
Denmark.
There you go.
Yes.
Got there in the end.
And possibly England, because we've also got a semi-final. And if England come second in their group stages, and I think their pool is in Southampton, they come second, then they play the winner of the pool that's playing in Milton Keynes. And if they beat that team, then their semi-final match will be in Milton Keynes.
Oh.
Very exciting.
Yes.
So if they get far enough.
Yes, but they have to get far enough, but in the right way.
Oh, okay.
So come second in their pool and then win, and then they're playing at Milton Keynes.
Fingers crossed.
Yes, because I have tickets to the match and I would like to see the Lionesses.
So we've been involved in a heritage project around the Women's Euros. And a lot of it is focused on contemporary collecting, really, hasn't it?
Yes. But
I kind of was really interested to see if Milton Keynes had any more historical involvement in women's football. So I did a little bit of research on my own.
You're very good at that. Yes. Researching, not just wandering off on your own.
And obviously I found stuff, otherwise it would be a very short episode. So I'm going to tell you all about that today.
Excellent.
Is that okay?
Yes, please. Carry on.
So yeah, apologies. It's going to be a lot of my voice today. So firstly, I just want to give a bit of a national context to the history of women's football. And that's basically just to say that women have been playing football as long as men have. Like, we'd be naive to think otherwise. But, you know, the stories and that kind of stuff just not been told as much as men's football for various reasons that we'll talk about in a bit. There's actually a folk ritual around the country of like single women in the village playing the married women in the village, and then like the unmarried men coming to watch and seeing who they want to marry, which is we can only laugh about it now, I guess, but that was a thing.
Was it formally that, or is that just what kind of happened?
I don't know, actually.
It was kind of a predating pick the lady you want to marry
at a dance.
Yeah.
What's the logic, though? You picking the person who runs the fastest, who's best at aiming the ball and the goal? You want the goalie? Like, what's your plan of action here?
It depends.
Must be up to the individual man what he looks for in a woman.
You have to ask them, I guess.
Yeah.
So formal games began in the late 1800s, with some in Scotland, actually. And then in England, the first recorded game was in 1895, when the British Ladies FC, who were formed in 1894, they played a North of the Thames versus the South of the Thames game. I think the North won.
Is that North as in all the way up to Scotland, North of the Thames, or just in London, but North of the Thames?
Well, I wondered the same thing, but I think it was North all the way above London. And then maybe south all the way.
That seems slightly unfair. Speaking as a southerner, there's an awful lot more of England north of the Thames than there is south of the Thames.
Population density, though.
Yeah, the north one, so there we go.
Ooh.
Press reaction to the games was at best patronising and condescending. At worst, viciously misogynistic, really. So some sections of the press took the attitude, oh, look at the ladies playing football, giving it a go. It was more of a novelty and a spectacle to them, whereas other sections were very kind of vociferous in their opposition to it. It was kind of get back to the kitchen sort of attitudes, really. And public reaction was mixed, although games were extremely popular and they attracted huge crowds. In the First World War, they sort of saw the start of the first golden age of women's football. So where women were being drawn into the workplace in factories, the workers at the factories would get together and form teams and play. A good example of this is the Dick Kerr ladies of Preston. They were the sort of the most famous team of that time. And they actually played until 1965. And much has been made of the Football Association ban, as it should be. But it's important to understand exactly what was banned. So in 1921, the FA, the Football Association, banned women's football from taking place on any ground belonging to its members and from anyone involved with their members being involved in women's football. Its reasoning was, quote, "The game of football is quite unsuitable for females and ought not to be encouraged," end quote.
But they didn't say why it was unsuitable.
No. We'll have to draw our own conclusions. So the result of this kind of ban was that it made it far more difficult for women to play football. It put more obstacles in the way. So some teams would have to find new grounds, which might be unsuitable. You know, they might have big molehills, or they might have big holes in them, or be on a hill or something like that. And also they couldn't draw on the expertise of anyone who was at an established men's club, and that would sort of hamper the development, because basically you're just trying to reinvent the wheel. If you can't draw on the experience of people who have been there, done that, you're kind of doing it for yourself, really, aren't you?
And I would imagine that even if somebody wasn't already coaching a men's team, if the FA, the governing body of football, are saying women shouldn't play football, it's going to discourage anybody from wanting to work with them.
Mm-hmm. It puts a stigma on it as well, doesn't it? I mean, talking about the reasonings, like, behind the reasoning is obviously like a patriarchal view of how women should behave and act and what they should be doing. But also it hides the fact that some women's games were attracting larger audiences than the men's games. So in 1920, the Dick Kerr ladies, who we mentioned earlier, played St Helens at Goodison Park to a record crowd of 53,000 people.
Wow.
And apparently thousands more were locked outside. So the women's game was getting a little bit more popular than the men's game.
Can't have that.
But the ban didn't stop women's football from being played. They carried on. So in North Buckinghamshire area, there are occasional press reports of games at the odd fate in the early 20th century. One in Pottisbury was a married women versus single women game, where it's reported that the single women were bound to win as they were much more sprightly.
But how many got married as a result of this?
I don't know. Exactly.
Important statistic.
Yeah. We need the before and after marriage statistics.
Yeah.
It wasn't until 1936 when we get some actual teams being formed. Only seemed to be the first team, as they played a game where they sort of split into two teams and played each other. So that was in May 1936. They then played a Newport Pagnell and Wolverton combined team at Bury Field in Newport Pagnell. And having been to Bury Field, it's not the most ideal place to play football, I don't think. I think it's a hill, a bit of a hill.
I don't know, I've never been.
It's very odd. The only one, they won 4-1.
Nice.
And it saw an attendance of reportedly between 3,000 and 4,000 people, which is not a small amount, really, is it? And reportedly it was mostly men. The only captain was carried shoulder high through Newport High Street after their victory, which I thought was fun. And the match raised money for the Newport Nursing and Ambulance Society. And a return match in Oney raised money for the Oney Hospital and Nursing Funds.
And did Oney win that one as well?
I don't have the scoreline, but probably. And that was the point, really, actually. For the next couple of years, like, local teams were formed, and more often than not, they were raising money for a local charity, usually the Hospital Fund or the British Legion. So in times before the NHS, community fundraising for hospitals to buy equipment and fund buildings and things like that would happen quite a lot. And it just makes me imagine, like, some enterprising young girls, as women have so often had to be, like, sitting around thinking, like, how can we get to play football? Like, how can we come up with a socially acceptable way to, I don't know, kick a ball around a field? And then someone's like, oh, we should raise money for charity. Because, you know, it's okay if, you know, women are playing football, if they're giving back to the community in some sort of way. So the matches were sometimes also at fetes and carnivals, and that would make it more of an all-round entertainment experience as well. So the only reports of the Newport Pagnell and Wolverton team are of those two games. They're not mentioned again. The next team to be formed was New Bradwell, who played only in their debut game, and they lost 8-0 at the recreation ground on Newport Road in New Bradwell.
I always think it's a bit mean to keep scoring. Once you've got, yeah, I don't know, 3-4-0 up, I just feel you should ease back a bit.
Yeah.
It's still a good win, but 8-0 is just a
total
mean.
Decimation.
Yeah.
That's the only way to do it. You want to win physically and mentally.
I suppose I've been more on the side of the losing 8-0 than the winning 8-0 side of things. So perhaps I've got a skewed perspective on this.
As part of that game, a Mrs. Watson dressed as John Bull and led the two teams out. Betty Draper played for New Bradwell. She was New Bradwell's carnival queen and she kicked off the match. And actually the kit that New Bradwell were wearing or using was loaned by the New Bradwell sports section and St Peter's FC, who were one of the local men's teams. And they raised £14, which is over £1,000 in today's money.
Wow.
So it's no small sum, really, is it?
No.
And they were raising money for the hospital fund, and a person called P. Bardell was a referee.
Do we know if P. Bardell was male or female?
I suspect he was male, but I don't know for sure. So a return match reported animated scenes at New Bradwell, as 5 busloads of supporters, plus those in private cars and on bikes, accompanied the New Bradwell team to Oni. And New Bradwell had new boots, which were paid for by the hospital fund committee. So they had raised some money for them and they were like investing back into this and going, actually, we think this is going to be quite a good thing for us. So we'll buy you some new boots. You can carry on fundraising for us, because they were raising good money, I suppose. They were really invested.
I guess they wanted that. Maybe they thought if they've got new boots, they might get score some, so they want to keep playing. Whereas if they keep losing 8-0, then they might get disheartened and not
You're
want to
really
play anymore.
Upset about this 8-0, aren't you?
I mean, the scorelines get worse, Sarah, I'm afraid.
Okay. I'm not sure I want to listen anymore.
Because the two teams played again in August 1936, and again, only won by 10 goals to nil.
Oh, she's just mean.
No, I believe in New Bradwell. They've got this.
They could do it. Yeah, yeah. Actually, New Bradwell had a better time when Wolverton made their debut in August 1936. The match was played at Wolverton Park and New Bradwell won.
Woohoo!
3-2.
It's a much nicer scoreline.
And the match reportedly drew a crowd of around 1,000 spectators. The other thing I love about these matches is that there was very often a dance afterwards. And it like reminds me of playing roller derby. And I know you said when you played, Sarah, when you played hockey, like you'd always have a party afterwards. So you'd be like playing your sport and then going out afterwards and having a lovely time.
Yes. Drowning your sorrows or celebrating.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that social aspect, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you have the same in your sports?
Fences are a bit pretentious.
Okay.
So
no partying?
No. not that I've encountered yet. Maybe.
You'll have to organise one.
Absolutely.
So when Stoney made their debut, Stoney Stratford made their debut, they played the formidable Olney side and they lost 9-0.
So it's just Olney are the problem, actually.
I'm going to go with Olney were just fantastic and everybody else was okay and good, not that everybody else was rubbish.
They were much more experienced, I would say. So that game they played at Mr. Toombs Field in Stony Stratford, which I think is just behind Vicarage Walk or just off Vicarage. And there was a dance at the Swan afterwards where music was provided by the Toaster Piano Accordion Band.
Wow,
sounds great. And actually the Stony team are interesting because from the newspaper reports, we have the most details about them. They always held games raising funds for the Stony branch of the British Legion. And they were nicknamed the Canaries because of the colour of their jerseys. But the newspaper report didn't say what colour their jerseys were. But I'm assuming yellow.
I would assume yellow. They're called the Canaries.
Yeah. And interestingly, one report says their youngest player was 12 and a half and their oldest player was 16.
So it's wow. Because I was picturing them all being more late teens, 20s, maybe even some into their 30s.
Yeah, and maybe that's why the only team trashed them 9-0. Like, what if the only team was just adults just running circles around a 12 and a half year old?
Could be. I think there's a real mixture.
Just having played hockey against young people, they run faster. So I would think they'd be more likely to be running rings around.
How are you being outrun by children?
Well,
we've already established she wasn't very good. That's what you implied yourself.
I wasn't always losing that badly. Just when there were lots of 12-year-olds on the opposing team.
So I guess the Sony's team was a real like schoolgirl endeavour. Like a bunch of teenagers just wanting to play a sport, do some extracurricular activity, hang out with their friends. Really wholesome stuff.
Yes.
In February 1937, the British Legion held a dinner to thank the Stony team for their fundraising efforts. So the team had raised £40, and then after buying kit and other expenses, they gave £14 to the Legion, which, as we know from before, £14 is roughly £1,000 in today's money. The team's captain, who was called Peggy Pallett,
It's an excellent name.
It's a great name. She thanked the Legion for looking after them at games. And a Mr. A.P. Gummidge made a speech describing how low funds were for the Legion before the, quote, brainwave of women's football matches. He also said that women's football was here to stay and they wouldn't take notice of any opposition.
Excellent.
So that kind of indicates they'd had some negativity towards the team and the games. But they were there saying, this is a good thing, and we want to continue it. And then after the dinner, they all had a dance.
Although, if they were 12 and, what was it, 12 to 18?
16.
I hope they weren't out too late.
I know.
So it wasn't a school night.
Hopefully
not. Going out, dining and dancing.
Yeah, I don't want the British Legion leading them astray.
No.
Bletchley also had a team, and the first report I came across for them was November 1936. I mean, I only really have details of the Bletchley team when they played a more northerly team, and it was sort of recorded in the Wolverton Express or the Northampton Chronicle or something like that, because I haven't yet gone and looked at the Bletchley Gazette newspapers.
If they didn't get to play local champs, the only team?
No, not so. Well, they might have done, actually. I'll refer you to my spreadsheet of games that I've made and score lines.
The 15-0 game.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
You're not just keeping that one back so I don't cry.
Oh, yeah, I'm not, because I'm from Bletchley, I'm not sort of saying all their negative things. But Bletchley actually played New Bradwell as part of New Bradwell's coronation celebrations in May 1937. So when George VI was crowned and they were all celebrating, there was a fete and a bonfire and fireworks.
Dancing?
It doesn't specifically mention dancing, but I would hope so.
There's going to be dancing.
Yeah. And New Bradwell beat Bletchley by 5-0.
They were also, Bletchley.
They were also raising funds for the hospital as well.
New Bradwell.
They're getting there, aren't they? The matches continued throughout 1937, so with wider teams from the wider area, such as Bosiat, Earlsbarton and Wollaston, appearing in news reports. But by 1938, it seems that Oney and Bosiat were the only two teams remaining in the local area. There was a news report that the organisers of the fete in New Bradwell were going to ask them to play at the fete because they were the only two teams left. But there's no news report of whether they did play or not. There's no indication of why the team stopped. Like, I've talked to a few people about this, and a lot of people suggest, like, the imminence of war. It's 1938, so maybe that was having an impact, but I'm not entirely convinced by this. I don't...
Not if they were that young, you wouldn't think the war would stop them playing.
No, and I've just been looking at, like, an item from the collection. That's a book about the railway companies encouraging people to go on holiday in 1940. So I'm thinking, like, you know, surely a bit of football's not going to affect the war.
No. Did the clubs get merged?
Not as far as I know, no. I think, like, we know how easy it is for sports teams to fold, like, if a few lose interest or the main driving forces move on, and maybe the crowds were waning, so, like, the charities weren't willing to support them if the funds weren't coming in.
Yes, I suppose there might have been fewer people that wanted to go and watch the matches and buy the tickets.
Yeah, it could have been all sorts of things, really. Just to bring it a bit more up to date in the national context, the Women's Football Association was formed in 1969 as attitudes started changing. The FA ban was eventually lifted in 1971, and the first Women's FA Cup final was played, which was won by Southampton.
Woohoo!
Which we're very pleased about.
Yes.
And the first, quote, official FA Women's International in Britain was played between England and Scotland in 1972, with England winning 3-2. And actually, I really love that because it's 100 years after the first ever international men's game, which was in 1872, and was also between England and Scotland. But that was a 0-0 draw, so, like, at least the women's team had, the women's game had goals.
Yes, sounds like a much more interesting match.
Mm, yeah. So that's, like, a little bit of the story behind some of the historical teams in the local area who played women's football. And as part of our heritage project, we are looking to collect objects relating to local women's football. So if you know someone, or if you play, or if you're involved, then we would really be interested in...
Yes, please get in touch at collections@mkmuseum.org.uk. And we're really interested in almost anything to do with women's football. So whether that's bits of kit, photographs, trophies, medals, programmes, absolutely anything. And not just players. So if you've coached, or you're a referee or the lines person or anything to do with women's football, or even if you're just a fan and you've got programmes or anything that you've collected or tickets, we'd be interested in absolutely anything.
Yeah, because we've got pretty much nothing, haven't we? And men's football, and obviously men's sport, is fairly well represented in the collection. But as I was saying before, like, those stories of women playing sports, and especially football, is not so well documented. So your story matters, like, even if you think it doesn't. And I often think that women feel like, oh, they don't want what I've got. And we find it harder to kind of think that what we've got matters. It does matter, and we want to represent it in our collections. So we would love to hear from you.
Yes.
If you're going to any of the games, then do enjoy.
Yes. There should be some photographic competitions and things, which I can't remember what the name of the place is.
Destination MK.
Destination MK are going to be running. So take lots of pictures and use whatever hashtags that they have, because, again, we'll be looking at those potentially to acquiring some of them. And any programmes or memorabilia that you pick up to do with the matches that are happening in Milton Keynes, we'd also be interested in things like that.
Yeah. And next month, what are we talking about next month?
Bradwell. Yes.
So we will see you next month for Bradwell.
Thank you. That's it for this episode. If you've got an idea for a future topic you'd like us to feature, then get in touch with us via social media. We're at MK Museum on Twitter and Facebook, and at Milton Keynes Museum on Instagram. Also, check out our website, miltonkeynesmuseum.org.uk.